rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lawrence Delalio, Sumo Likishi Dezu. Lawrence Delalio is a sumo wrestler. He's got the fill for it.
This is The Ruck, the rugby podcast from The Times. I'm Lawrence Delalio, and joining me all the way from Japan are The Times' top team of Owen Slott and Stephen Jones. Gentlemen, it's been quite a build-up to the start of the tournament. You're finally out in Japan. Jonesy, if I can start with you. Konnichiwa, my friend. What's it been like out there in the first few days?
It's been wonderful. Just a blizzard of things on the brain, really. Just to go around Tokyo when you don't know the city is staggeringly difficult, but actually a bit of fun and a bit dangerous. So far, I think there was 24 in the press corps when we started. Only 19 are still going. The other five we haven't seen for 48 hours. So it is difficult to get round, but the atmosphere here is tremendous. The people are clearly clued into it and know it's going on. The numbers in terms of commercial are just off the scale. So it's fun. I'm missing Slotty, though, because he's in another end of the country, and I'm finding it difficult to cope without him.
I was just going to say, so Jonesy, you're in Tokyo, I'm assuming, and Owen, you're somewhere completely different, maybe in the north part of the island?
Lawrence, I had a couple of days with Jonesy in Tokyo, and then we parted, sadly. I've gone to Sapporo in the North Island, where England are preparing for their opening game against Tonga on Sunday, so I'm up here. It's a bit colder. It's not very good for my tan, actually. but I did go for a run down the river yesterday, and I got back in one piece.
And have any of you sort of caught up with? I mean, Owen, have you managed to catch up with some of the teams as they build up towards their opening games?
I've seen the All Blacks. I've seen Steve Hansen talking out the side of his mouth like he always does. I've seen Japan, which is hilarious because you go to a Japan press conference and there's normally about two hilarious questions to one rugby question. So, like, you know, what hairstyle are you sporting today, and why have you chosen that before someone asks, you know, how's your spin pass?
Do they ask you what the emoji of the day is or something? I mean,
that's part of the charm of this whole thing, I suppose, is it's just different culturally. I mean, I know that's a sort of statement of the obvious, but it's just very different culturally to what we're used to. In these big official press conferences now, there's always a Japanese translator. And I was with the Australians today, and Michael Checker was saying something, and then it was being translated. And after about two sentences translation, he turned around to this translator and he said, thanks for that, because I think you understand me better than I understand myself.
Jonesy, for you, you're in Tokyo. You know, who have you bumped into?
I'm speaking to you from the team hotel of the Russians. And you wouldn't call them a minnow because they all look about 6'10". It is amazing these days, you know. You think, oh, Russians, they'd all be sort of, almost typical Soviets from the Soviet era would be. No smiling, dressed in dowdy old tracksuits, but they look like a professional rugby team, just like all the others. They're very outgoing, very easy. Some of them speak good English because they got two Sale Sharks players for a start. But what you do think they might struggle in the first game, Lawrence, is they're big blokes and they're chunky blokes, and it's a very, very hot atmosphere here, very humid. And they'll be up against a smaller, but I think probably vastly fitter and faster team. So I think it'll be, from what I see, the Russians working on the fight, they're big lads, but I think they'll be really up against it and possibly really blowing in the last, say, 20 minutes. So that's where the game we won and lost. But they're great guys. They're absolutely delighted to be here. most of them are from Russian domestic rugby, all bar two or three. So it'll be fascinating to see how they get on, but they're just loving it.
Listen, we're going to get on to the opening game, but must just touch on the breaking news, I guess, the Rob Howley sort of betting incident. We're going to talk to our very own Steve James from The Times shortly, and I'm sure he'll probably have hopefully the inside track or a little bit more information. But just from your point of view, Jonesy, just your take on it. It's obviously very sad for the player himself, or the coach, who's now back in Bridgend, but it's been big news over here.
Yeah, it has. And look, we know, Lawrence, from other sports, from cricket, etc., how the activities of bookmakers and people betting. I mean, no one's saying that Rob is with an illegal bookmaker, by the way, can cause such grief. And first of all, you think with Rob, if it's proven guilty and if he did make bets on rugby games, which is illegal. You know, what a silly, stupid thing to do. Before the tournament, they were all warned. It's not just coaches, it's players, it's medical staff, it's even the groundsmen. They're not allowed to make bets either. But on the other hand, anyone who thinks that Rob Howley is some sort of big, high-rolling crook is way off the mark. You know him well from your WASP days. Yeah. He's an absolutely fantastic guy. He's quiet. He's modest. If it's proven, he's made a huge error. If I know Rob, it won't be in terms of tens of thousands of pounds. It'll be a bet here and there. But on the other hand, I've got I've got a lot of sympathy for the guy, and he's messed up what could have been the peak of his career.
Owen, do you think it begs the question that, you know, we know that that clearly if you're a player, a coach, someone who's associated with the game, that you're not allowed to place bets on your own sport, but probably highlights to everyone at the front end that we just need to remind people of this all the time, and maybe sadly for Rob, you know, him being sent home will be a very clear reminder to everyone, you know, what is allowed and what's not allowed.
Yeah, completely agree. We don't know what he's done, but I think that the most people, Jonesy said himself, suspects that he just placed a bet. He's not trying to fix a game or hand over information like some people within cricket who've been involved in this sort of thing have done. In one respect, it says we're taking this seriously. You know, it's not people just putting words to it, saying that we're trying to cut out betting and this sort of thing. I mean, I reckon that the common man, when this has all happened, the common man will go that he had served a very severe sentence for what actually happened. But it does ram home that message. You know, we're taking this seriously. No betting in the sport you're involved in.
Well, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Steve James of The Times. Steve, konnichiwa. I understand you had quite an interesting first few hours in Japan when you landed. You probably did exactly what we'd all do and get some shut-eye and go straight to bed. But obviously, while you were asleep, the rugby world decided, you know, that they had other things on their mind.
Yeah, hi, Lawrence. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, a bit of jet lag, so I thought I'd get some sleep. Just went to the toilet, actually, in the middle of the night and saw my phone was flashing. Yeah, not great timing, but yeah, it's been fairly eventful since then, trying to sort of catch up on everything that's happened.
And if we could just sort of develop on the Rob Howley story, you know, chatting to Jonesy and to Slotty a little bit earlier on. I mean, you know, it's obviously the breaking news. Just give us your take on it. And more importantly, you know, what I'd like to know is how you think it's going to affect the Wales camp, if at all.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say, you know, it's very sad for Rob himself. I mean, you obviously know him very well, Lawrence, and played a lot with him. He's a good man, isn't he, Rob? And we don't know the full details of what's happened. We don't exactly know what the allegation is. There's a lot of rumour out there in these days of social media. You know, people are very, very quick to jump to conclusions. So until we actually know exactly what's happened, you know, it's hard to pass real judgment. Something's obviously happened, and you know, maybe Rob has made a mistake. You know, he's paying a big price for it, isn't it? He's been sent home, and that in itself is embarrassing and humiliating for him. I mean, moving on to the second point, what sort of impact it will have on the Wales team? I mean, it'll obviously have some impact, won't it? Because Rob's been there for 11, 12 years as Warren Gatland's right-hand man. And I know suddenly, you know, a few days before the World Cup starts, he's not there. You know, Stephen Jones is an excellent coach, and everyone speaks very highly of him. I'm sure he'll come in and do a good job. But, you know, he hasn't been in that group, has he? And Warren Gatland always liked to play his rugby in a certain way. So it won't be easy for him to fit in that seamlessly, I wouldn't have thought. But Warren Gatland's good in the versatility, as you know, Lance. I think he can get things together. I think the good thing is they've got a fair bit of time before that first game. You know, they've had time to digest this news and to get things sorted for Monday's game against Georgia. And I think Sam Walter made a good point in his column this morning that Wales are used to sort of swapping around coaches. You know, Warren's been off to those two Lions tours and Rob Howley's taken over. And Sam made the point that he was actually quite surprised how well the team had sort of taken to that. And he expects them to do the same this week.
I was going to say, it probably suits them now that their match is not until after the weekend, so they can just, you know, allow the rugby to kick off and just take stock and watch everyone else play. And hopefully, I'm sure, as we all expect, as soon as the rugby starts, you know, the stories will be thrown up thick and fast, and there'll be more about what's happening on the pitch, and Wales can just take stock from that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the rugby starts tomorrow, isn't it, Japan, Russia here in Tokyo, and you're right, you know, the focus then will turn to the rugby. That's the thing. This week there hasn't been any rugby. You know, this has been a huge story and everyone's been all over it. And Sam made another good point, you know, these first couple of days would have been the hardest because, you know, there's another press conference today when Robin Bride, the forwards coach, and Reece Patchell were put up, you know, and everyone's asking them about Rob Howley, you know, they want to talk about Georgia, and everyone's asking about Rob Howley. So, yeah, the first few days are going to be the most difficult. But as you say, you know, once the rugby starts, and there's some huge games this weekend, but the focus will turn to that, and it'll turn away from Rob Howley in that situation.
Well, gents, Slotty, Jonesy, you know, I'm sure that's a pretty harsh lesson for us all. We've got to set our alarm clocks and make sure that we wake up when we're supposed to, really.
First of all, I want some evidence, Lawrence, that Chemo is in Tokyo. He allegedly arrived 48 hours ago. He said before he came out that when he got there, he wanted a good night out, a good drink with the lads. We gathered in his hotel foyer. At the time he said he'd be there, seven of us. 6 hours we waited for Rip Van James to get up. All he's done so far in 48 hours he's been here is give quotes from the Sam Warburton column, which he ghosted himself this morning. And some of us were expecting a much bigger impact from this experienced tourist. We thought he'd be immune to that night. And I have to say, talking about Stephen Jones, my namesake making an impact with Wales, well, if he makes as big an impact as Steve James, Wales could easily lose to Georgia.
Where are you, Jonesy? I thought you were supposed to be in Tokyo.
I am in Tokyo. I haven't seen any evidence that you are. I've been in Tokyo covering press conferences, finding out pathfinding ways to ground stadiums. I was at the inaugural press conference every day. I'd look for my mate, J-Mo, my mate, the man who once scored 100% one game at Colwyn Bay. No sign of you at all.
Steve, just to clarify, Jonesy's in the team hotel of the Russian rugby team, so it's probably a very nice five-star hotel knowing the Russians.
That's what I was going to say, Lawrence. I mean, he's obviously in the posh hotel in the centre of town, and I'm in... slightly less posh hotel in the suburbs somewhere. It'll take me a long time to get.
All hotels were allocated according to status in the rugby rights community.
Exactly.
five-star hotel. But you're now in the B&B across town that you're really going to deserve.
Well, Jonesy, while you finish that plate of caviar that's in front of you, we really appreciate your time. We know you've been incredibly busy over the last 48 hours. And... Don't forget to set your alarm clock. But thanks for joining us.
Cheers, boys.
Japan faced Russia in the opening match tomorrow night. Slotty and Jonesy have been down to the Tokyo Stadium for a taste of the atmosphere.
Owen, we've come on a very long journey. And where are we? Well, the clue is the distant strains of a grass cutter out on the field.
Yeah, Jonesy, we've just nailed it, haven't we? We've been on the tube or the subway or the metro, whatever you want to call it, the KO line. Get off at stop 20 at Tobitakekatiu. Yes. Did I pronounce that right? And you find your way to the Ajinomoto Stadium, which is Tokyo's main stadium, where the opening game will be tomorrow night.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got a lovely feel to it. In fact, everything we've done so far has had a lovely feel to it, because people are so friendly and so lovely. And I get the impression it's going to be just a wonderful World Cup. Just a word about the stadium. This is where the opening game and the opening ceremony is, not where the final is. It is a lovely stadium. You wouldn't call it colossal or monumental like the Real Madrid Stadium or like Tottenham Hotspur, but it's just a nice open stadium, and you wouldn't want a seat in the sun here, but it is nice. It's got a nice feel to it.
It's going to be cracking here on Friday night, tomorrow night, that is, and we know that, because I think if there's one thing you can be sure about, the local Japanese crowd are going to go really, really big for this. I don't know how much they'll know about what's going on. That might sound a bit dismissive, but I think that's probably fair enough. But the news is, don't sneeze on the tube, isn't it?
Well, you did two things that are not de rigueur. You sneezed on the tube and you spoke in a loud voice.
Yeah.
And then it was packed. It was a packed carriage, but the next stop they all got off, scowling at you. And we warned you about this. But you shouldn't have worn a mask. But you sneezed loudly. They all jumped out the way, and then they all left. So we left just us in the carriage. So it was an early breach of etiquette.
I tried bowing to them, but it didn't make any difference.
No, they just thought you were making fun of them then when you did that. But there's been lovely stories all over the country already. Like 15,000 people went to watch the Welsh rugby training and then sang the Land of My Fathers.
That looked amazing, didn't
it? Yeah, it did. I mean, for everyone to learn that. I mean, more people know that in Japan than they do in Wales now, I think, that anthem. But then there's just stuff like that all over the country. And people couldn't have been nicer. We get huge reactions when we use our full Japanese vocabulary at them, don't we? It's alligator, isn't it, for... thank you. Or is it alligator?
No, you're just pretending now.
No, I am.
You are.
We got on. Well, we're getting on okay. I said yamata. That means see you again, which you say when you go to a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Yamata. And they say, right, fair enough.
Were you good at ordering your dinner last night?
No, we had one of those menus with pictures on. We had to point at it. We're not that good. But we go on okay.
Reject your credit card again?
No, they didn't do that.
Oh, that's either. The man from The Guardian, isn't it?
No,
the man from The Guardian can't get a meal.
Well, he can't. The problem is he doesn't realise you've got to pay a certain amount back every month, I think, with The Guardian. But it was fine. And I just, it's warm. In fact, it's bloody hot. And Lawrence will be back there sitting in a nice air-conditioned studio, won't he?
He will.
He'll have his shirt sleeves. He won't be at the front where the tough boys are.
We miss you, Lawrence.
Yeah, do we? That's not what you said earlier. Yeah, we do miss you, Lol. And I hope you're keeping the audience riveted back there.
Well, that all sounded like it looked pretty amazing. Owen, give us an idea of the stadium and what we can all expect.
The stadium is 49,500, I think. So that's pretty big. Not quite the Nou Camp or anything, but it'll be. I mean, I think we know it will be heaving. I think we know that the Japanese crowd will be very loud and passionate, and I think it'll be riotous. Actually, I also think it helps that Japan will win. I hope they don't win by too much, because I suspect that Russia might be the one team that really aren't up to it. I mean, it's another long story, but they shouldn't really be here. But that's another corruption story we can talk about another time. Russia did actually lose to Jersey in their warm-up campaign. That's Jersey from the English Championship. So I think Japan will win. I think they'll score a hatful of tries. But bizarrely, that might actually be what the World Cup needs, you know, as in the host nation will go, wow, this is great, aren't we good?
Well, we all remember what Japan did on that extraordinary day in Brighton in 2015. But I'm assuming, you know, to get the perfect start to the World Cup, that's exactly what we want, don't we, Jonesy? We want a big Japanese victory, and maybe that'll make sure that the nations sort of take note of what's going on in their own backyard.
Yeah, it's funny, though, because you think a lot of the Japanese people would be sort of almost unaware of it, but they did give out the stat that something like nearly 90% of the population are aware of it, and, you know, of which many would be supporting. So They don't get many Japanese national teams in any sport taking part in massive global events. So I think they'll be well switched onto it anyway. And I think that people are still using the miracle of Brighton to push this World Cup, because that is something that was just absolutely transforming over here and put them back on the map. But I think it is important they get off. And like Owen, I hope Russia don't go down by too many. But it is just worth recalling that I think they finished fourth in the qualifying. The top three teams above them in the European Nations Cup were all disqualified for various reasons. Mm. It was Spain who should have been here and were the best of the teams. But not only was Spain knocked out by an absolutely disgusting performance of refereeing by a Romanian, who were the other likely qualifiers, but which was just absolutely bizarre. But also the top three teams. Let's put it another way. Russia are in this tournament because all the players in the qualifying were found out to be qualified to play for Russia, which the others weren't. But having said that, they're big lads with professional experience. Kingsley Jones, the coach, is a good lad who's seen everything and done everything. So I just think they might be competitive, but I think they might be lacking a little edge of fitness.
And for our podcast listeners who perhaps don't know much about Japanese rugby, I know they went down recently to South Africa in their final warm-up game, but who are the stars on show that we can look out for that are going to sort of make a name for themselves in this World Cup?
The team's led by Michael Leach, one of the sort of prime movers in the Miracle of Brighton. Actually, Lance, it's another point worth making here, that we see Miracle. It didn't come out of thin air, because that winning try was nothing remotely sort of fortuitous about it. The winning try, we all remember in the left-hand corner, was absolutely brilliant bit of rugby. Leach and is still there, still the key man. Their second row is those two well-known Japanese, Wimpy van der Velde and James Moore, in the second row. But a lot of the power comes from Kazuki Himeno, who is the number eight and one of the great carriers. Not as big as Billy Vonopola, but still a great carrier. A lot of it comes from him. And Keita Inagaki, the loosehead prop, is also class scrummager, maybe even the world-class scrummager. So they have got forwards and bigger forwards than normal. Michael is the key.
The player that I think sort of might stir the spirits of the watching home nation is their winger, Katoro Matsushima, South African born to Zimbabwean dad and Japanese mother, has spent almost all his life here, and he's been scoring quite a lot of tries recently, so I think he could potentially be the home star.
Want to know how the lead singer of a death metal band has been helping the Japanese team to prepare for the big kickoff? Of course you do. Slotty's been inside the Japanese camp to find out.
I'm here at the Japan Hotel, and I've got an exclusive interview with the interpreter to the Japanese team, who is unique because can interpret pretty darn well. He's also a lead singer in a death metal band. So can we say a big hello to Hidenori Sato? Lovely to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Give us an idea on the sort of music you like to make.
We play in a death metal band, but there's like a subgenre in death metal. We play the most hardcore death metal, which is called brutal death metal. And it's just intense and brutal. And yeah, it might be... unfamiliar for some of the people, but it might sound like a noise, mm-hmm. but there's a great art in that music. You need a great musicianship and techniques and drums and guitars and basses.
And would you say it's a fairly uncompromising sound then?
Yes, uncompromising. It's just brutal in your face. And I just love it.
And would you say that having worked under Eddie Jones for 8 months back in 2015 sort of prepared you for uncompromising attitude to life?
Yeah, he's got the raging sound to it. Added a bit more intense anger. Not towards Eddie. But how Eddie gets all filled up.
What do Japanese make of your noise?
The Japanese scene is very small. So we toured the States three times.
And right.
It's a big scene in Southeast Asia,
right.
Like Thailand.
What language are you singing in?
English, okay. But nobody understands, so it doesn't really matter.
Right.
I'm just growling and screaming.
Do you have any rugby reference in your sound?
Not really. I try to separate rugby with death metal.
And what are the Japan team like?
It's different to Eddie Japan with Jamie Joseph Japan. Mm-hmm. But it's more responsibility on the players, more independent. And they have to think on their own feet, and they've got more, you know, yeah. They have to, you know, be more professional mindset and everything. And now the players fully understand what's required of them. So it's really in a good position to get into the first match.
And what was it like under Eddie?
Oh, it was more like, I wouldn't say controlled in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was just micromanaged, and the players knew exactly what they had to do. And from like each game, from the first minute till the 80th minute.
Yeah,
and the schedule was more hectic. You know, everything was like, for them to have a power nap, it was everything controlled. Yeah.
Well, he controlled when they had a power nap?
Yeah.
All right.
That was in the schedule.
Did he allow you a power nap?
Not really. I only could get power nap when he was power napping.
Did he allow you a way to go and practice your death metal?
No. I didn't. I spent time with him for almost 180 days, pretty much straight. I only had like a day or two break between the camps.
Did he listen to your music?
I had to.
Did he listen to your music?
Nah. All the coaches watched my video and everything, but I used to make fun of my music. Not make fun of my music, just you know, tease. We would arrive at the next destination on the bus, and he'll get me to pick up the mic, and you know, there's a microphone on the bus, and he goes, give the boys a scream, wake them up and stuff like that.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how much were the players scared of Eddie?
11.
You're being generous there, more than that. And yourself?
Oh, yeah, pretty much the same. Not scared. It's just there's such a high demand with the professionalism, you know, all the time. In hindsight, I'm really glad that I've got to experience working with Eddie, what it takes to become a true professional, and you know, what it takes to achieve a goal, mm-hmm. Extreme goal.
Mm-hmm. And seriously, here in Japan, I've been in Tokyo for only 24 hours now, and you can see and feel rugby around on the sort of signs, yeah, on the buildings, etc. For you, as a rugby, someone working in rugby, a rugby fanatic, Japanese, how important, how big is this World Cup for you and for your country?
It's really important, and there's a massive responsibility on the Japanese rugby to perform well, because I don't think the Japanese rugby industry expanded on rugby after that huge success in 2015. You know, sort of like died off a bit, and the Japanese culture, they tend to, you know, they love jumping on the bandwagon. Yeah. So if anything goes boom, then everyone jumps on it, and then as long as you try to sustain it by, you know, keeping more interesting, attractive, then it'll be ingrained into Japanese like sporting culture. But for this tournament, and how big it is, and there's so much attention to the tournament and the sports itself, it's crucial for the team to, you know, maybe not, of course, to achieve the goal, but to play well as well.
And for a translator interpreter, what are the hardest words to the hardest rugby terms to translate from English, its natural language, into Japanese?
One phrase that I struggled, there are a few phrases with Eddie. Like, Jimmy's are pretty generous, you know. They just want to refer back to Eddie, but one time the players weren't really, you know, putting their bodies on the line, and they weren't being aggressive with the breakdown session. So yeah. He just screamed at them and said, go get your dancing shoes on.
Yeah.
It's hard to interpret that.
Could you give us, go get your fucking dance shoes on in Japanese?
Dance shoes motte koi.
Oh.
But that just doesn't make sense for the Japanese guys.
What is it?
So, like, you know, it just means to get serious. So if you want to start dancing, you know, you might as well bring your dancing shoes on. But that's just a different humor. So if I directly translate that, they go, dancing shoes? Yeah. What for? Or one time he said that the next game's referee, he's audacious. And I just didn't know that word, audacious. And I had to ask this other coach. And he goes, I said, sorry, Eddie, what does audacious mean? And he goes, he's got his f***ing c*** up his ass. I just didn't know how to put that into Japanese. And the Lee Jones, the defense coach, said, oh, he's just arrogant. So I said, oh, okay.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, brilliant insight there into the mindset of Eddie Jones and what he's got prepared for the England team. If we can head now straight to Alex Lowe, who's in Sapporo. Alex, lovely to hear from you. I understand you've been with the England camp and you managed to sneak in and watch them train for 20 minutes.
We spent last week in Miyazaki, England's sort of high humidity training base, which is the same place that Eddie Jones took Japan and sort of plotted their 2015 campaign and that famous win against the Springboks. We then flew up yesterday to Sapporo, where we've gone from the heat and humidity to rain and cool, and England were training in the rain today. The way it works at the World Cup is that the teams have to open their doors to training sessions for 20 minutes, and so they usually structure their sessions so that we get to see them doing some fitness drills, running up and down and lifting a few weights, which is pretty much what we saw them doing today. And then once the doors were shut, they would have gone and done their big training session of the week before the Tonga game. I think Eddie Jones will already know the team he wants to pick, but it's only after the big session of the week that he actually nails it down and starts telling the players, and that happened today.
I mean, usually you can tell from the bibs that the players are wearing who's in the starting 15 and the ones that maybe are being kept behind. I mean, if Eddie Jones knows the team that he's going to play, he's probably the only person, because certainly he's been keeping everyone guessing as to what his strongest 15, what his strongest squad is likely to be. Given the way that the fixtures fall for England at this World Cup, Alex, do you feel he won't be pressured into putting his strongest team out in the first game?
He definitely won't feel pressured. In fact, I think he's rather changed his mind on that. When he came out here about a year ago on a recce, he was talking then about the importance of naming his strongest team in the first game and then making a few changes for the USA game 4 days later. In the intervening 12 months, in fact, he was talking about this the other day, he read a book about Pep Guardiola's first season at Bayern Munich, where in the 60-game season they had, Pep Guardiola only had his first 11 available for one of those 60 games. And I think we saw through the warm-up matches how he's training different styles of play, so different combinations. And I think he comes into the World Cup not necessarily with the first 15, but just with different combinations that he might want to play. So, for example, Ford Farrell, Tuilagi, or Farrell, Tuilagi, Slade. You know, different dynamics in the back line. You know, and he's got a back three with a host of different options from the size of Cochrane Singer to the sort of the work rate of Jack Noll when he's fit. So I think he will mix and match to a degree in the next two matches, because a couple of players will have to double up. And I would expect them to be the more fringe players, like a Lewis Ludlam and maybe a Rory McConachy. And then when he gets to the two crunch pool matches, Argentina and France, we'll see what looks to be the strongest team, but actually he could easily pick a different style of team for each of those games to sort of combat the style of the opposition that England come across.
Owen, do you think that's justified, given the England's games get harder and harder, that he holds back, some of his frontline players until maybe even the Argentina game?
Yeah, I think it's justified. I think the players themselves, you'd know yourself, Ron, you're just desperate to get into it, aren't you?
Yeah.
They'll have been here 2 weeks before before their first game. They just want to get on with it. At the same time, these are games that we know England should win. And if they were to sustain a big injury to a frontline player, it would be a huge shame. But I think you can't really protect players. You can't go into World Cup playing that sort of game for too long. I think everyone gets some part of a game before Argentina, and as you say, once we get there, then we'll actually really see what his team looks like.
I'm just interested, Jonesy, from a Billy Vunipola perspective. I made no secret of the fact I think he's England's most important player. He is from Tongan descent. He played all four warm-up games. I think he played every minute of all England's four warm-up games. I wouldn't be surprised if Eddie Jones just says, well, you're okay, actually. I don't want to risk losing you in this first game and maybe sit down and just mix and match the team a little bit.
I think that's a very fair point as far as Billy goes, Lawrence, because he is head and shoulders above and one of the great carriers and a titan. But I have to say, the scenario which Alex explained so beautifully there, It which totally reflects what Eddie is going to do. If they should go into the Argentinian game, maybe even the French game, and it's the first time that their top team has played together forever, and if they lose that, then it'll be all on Eddie's head, because whatever happened to building a team, building a first team with confidence and with its rhythm and understanding the player next to you. It's not very well saying we'll play combinations, we'll play 10, 12, 13, but 10, 12, 13 exists with the 9 and with the 15 and with their wings and with the number 8. And he is quietly rewriting the whole history of preparation, in which you try and work out what your first team is. Yeah. Now, in 2003, I'm sure they hate being reminded of that, when England won the World Cup, we knew what the first team was a year before. At least we knew what 14 of them were. And Eddie has done it totally different. And I only hope for his sake that he's got it right, because it could be described as a total incoherence.
Well, I say Eddie Jones is the only man who knows the England first team. I'm sure, Alex, we've given you long enough on the ground now in Japan. You know, I'm pretty sure you must have a fairly clear insight.
You mentioned Billy there. I think he's likely to start. The main reason for that is that Mark Wilson has been struggling with a knee injury since the Italy game and was really only declared fully fit earlier today. And I'm just not sure that's enough time for him to play in this game. I suspect that Billy Funipola will start this game and then maybe sit out the USA game with Mark Wilson playing number 8 against the USA and maybe Lewis Ludlam doubling up so they don't have to run Curry and Underhill for two full matches together. We spoke to Scott Weisenmantle earlier this week, the attack coach, and he does a lot of work through World Rugby with Pacific Island Nations. He works on this Pacific Combine that they have, which is to try and give promising players, get them a contract in the USA or in New Zealand, might attend, even in Spain. We were talking about the style of rugby they like to play, and of course the Tongans are known for their physicality. And he talked a lot about how England's plan, which I think will mirror what New Zealand did against Tonga the other week, where they put 90-odd points on them, is to avoid contact and to keep the ball moving. And joining the dots, that would point towards Ford and Farrell starting together. Mm. Or with Henry Slade now fit, there's also an argument that he could come in at the 13 as a triple threat, you know, player who can pass, run and kick, and get England attacking further out wide. They've got all the different playmakers available, Ford, Farrell, Daly, 15, and Slade. So how they balance that will be interesting to see when they name the team in the early hours of Friday. But that appears to be the way they're going to play. Rather than pick all the big guys and take them on head first, they've watched how New Zealand played against them the other week and I think plan to try and keep the ball alive as much as possible, play as quickly as possible. And that would point towards Ford and Farrell or perhaps Farrell and Slade outside centre.
Well, I certainly agree with you on the Slade issue. You know, he obviously missed all the warm-up games through injury. And there is one or two players in that England squad that are light on game time. And it wouldn't be surprising if, you know, Slade's definitely one of them, if Eddie Jones decides to put him in the team straight away, because otherwise, you know, he runs the risk of getting further on in the group without Slade having played a game. Owen, I'm just going to ask you the question that's on every England fan's minds. The back three, the makeup of the back three, obviously some wonderfully talented players there. Elliot Daly or Anthony Watson at fullback starting?
Eddie has backed himself into a corner on this one. He's gone with Elliot Daly through thick and thin. I thought that he should have tried Elliot Daly like 2 years ago, but I don't think the project worked. But I don't think Eddie's this is the belligerent Eddie Jones. He won't acknowledge that. He'll stick with Elliot Daly. If he shifted Daly out, it would be acknowledgement that he'd made a mistake. So I think he goes with Daly. And unfortunately, it's too late to try something else. But maybe they will get to that eventually. But I think Elliot Daly is the man. Eddie's been with him for a year now, and he won't be doing anything else.
And Jonesy, quick one on England's midfield options. A year ago, we would have said maybe Owen Farrell definitely starts at 10, Ford off the bench, and any one of a couple of different combinations at centre. Do you have the feeling, like a lot of England fans, that we're now moving towards a sort of Ford, Farrell at centre and Tuilagi combination?
I think we are moving towards that, Lawrence. Whether we should be is a totally different thing, because I think through all these soft games, and let's be fair, with one or two exceptions, the warm-up games are soft. The first two games down here, with respect to the opposition, are soft. I think that they should, if they're going to play the team that they want to play against, say, the All Blacks or South Africa or even France, they should stick with what where Eddie finally got to and have Farrell at 10 and have Tuilagi and Henry Slade outside him. I think it's the ideal combination, and anything apart from that is messing about. It is a giant, a World Cup for giants, a World Cup for power. We're going to need to see that Tuilagi keeps on his form. He's had one great game in about 5 years. Some of that was not his fault, but he's had one great game, so we want another one from him very, very soon. Slade's a brilliant player, and that means that Owen Farrell has to be the 10.
Just on the fullback debate, I think I might be in the minority on this podcast, but England are in a position where they don't have the perfect solution. They've got Mike Brown, who's very strong under the high ball, but doesn't have the attacking game or playmaking game that Eddie wants. Anthony Watson is a brilliant strike runner and more assured under the high ball than Elliot Daly. Elliot Daly offers England a reliable left-footed boot, a huge boot from the back, and acts as another playmaker coming into the line further out. And you know, while England aren't copying New Zealand, New Zealand are actually playing that way. This weekend, I'll have Beauden Barrett playing at fullback. I think we saw in the Six Nations the way that Farrell and Slade and Daly gave England a variety of playmaking options. I mean, you have to remember that the Ireland game, the number of tries that were created by Daly and Slade wider out. So while I don't think England have the perfect answer to who they want at fullback, in my view, Daly actually ticks more of the boxes than any of the others, and it allows Watson to do what he does best, which is he can dominate the high ball out on the wing, but actually he's a finisher and a strike runner. And in my view, I think Daly is the better of the three options.
Alex, really appreciate you taking the time out to join us, and we'll be hearing a lot more from you as the World Cup unfolds. Thank you very much indeed.
No problem.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, if we look at the other matches on Saturday, Australia-Fiji, we had Ben Ryan, of course, on the podcast recently talking up Fiji's chances. Gentlemen, can we see anything other than Australian victory here? Or do you think Ben Ryan's got a point that if there is going to be one major upset, then possibly the Fijians are the team to cause it?
Do we see that as an upset? I think Fiji is certainly a team that can produce an upset. They have a record for improving through tournaments, which is very easy to explain because they spend hardly any time together. They don't get a lot of chance to improve with the team, apart from in World Cups, where suddenly they get 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks together and they get better and better. So I think they are this the almighty banana skin of this World Cup. And I think Australia have done well to get them first when they'll still be working stuff out. Fiji were beaten by Japan recently, for instance, but I think they'll be infinitely better than that. Australia got them at the right time, and the wrong time to get them is at the end of the group in 3-4 weeks' time, which is when Wales will get them. That'll be a different match altogether.
Well, there's no bigger game on Saturday. In fact, there's probably no bigger game in world rugby right now than the two favourites for the competition, New Zealand, the holders, won the last two Rugby World Cups, and South Africa. And that match, of course, is a huge pool game that kicks off on Saturday. Jonesy, South Africa look very settled, very quick to name their team, looks a very strong side, something like over 550-odd caps in that South African team. And what of New Zealand? Well, Owen, you were chatting to Steve Hansen, or you saw his press conference. But Jonesy, I'm going to go with you first to put the case forward for South Africa in this huge, huge pool clash.
Obviously, there's a case, Lawrence. And as the boys just said, this confusion between Barrett and Moanga at 10 and 15, which I think that it's now become a little bit like an Eddie Jones stubborn thing and a sort of dogmatic thing from Hansen that he's determined to push it through. That must give South Africa a chance. I think where New Zealand have always beaten South Africa is that they've waited until the storm has sort of abated and just waited and to stay in the game, and then they struck with by going wide and with attacking moves. It's South Africa. It's not questioned this week of their power and all that and their passion and their, you know, and their green jerseys. I think this week they've got to use their heads to beat New Zealand. If people like Pollard and Dikambia Am in the middle, if they can marshal the defence properly and if they can cope with the pace of the New Zealand game, I think they've got a wonderful chance. And what a start to the tournament that would be if the All Blacks lose first time up.
And Owen, you were at the New Zealand press conference. It's an interesting one for Steve Hansen. He's been there, done it all many, many times over. New Zealand normally go into these sort of tournaments with a lot of expectation and a lot of pressure. Is there just that little bit of doubt in that camp, or did you hear different from Steve Hansen?
Well, there is doubt, and that's because they've never had a group game like this before. They're always top seeds or thereabouts, and just because of the peculiarity of the seeding process, South Africa were way down when the draw was made. So New Zealand have never had a game like this before. The psychology of the game is interesting because while they both are desperate to win it, they also both know that they're going to go through even if they don't. You know, they'd have to lose to Italy for that not to be the case, and that's not going to happen. So I think it's one of those ones where they're playing for confidence, momentum, bragging rights. The players themselves are playing to try and impress the coaches so they can keep a foothold in the top choice team. But it's just unusual for a number of reasons. And there are a lot of people who think that this is a massive first-round group game and also potentially the final.
Whilst that one kicks off at 10:45 British time, the match that would have already been decided will be France-Argentina, which, of course, has huge ramifications for England in their group. That kicks off at 8:15 on Saturday morning. Jonesy, I'm not going to talk about the French in terms of being favourites because that would be wrong, but are we writing them off at our peril?
Yeah, of course we are, Lawrence. What we are going to find out is whether there is any danger to England winning the pool. It's as simple as that. Now, I think both the teams, France, as you say, and Argentina, they've got the capability to upset England, probably got the capability to beat them, but only on those days that are becoming really rare, and that is the days that they put it all together. Argentina, the sight of Argentina going backwards at a rate of knots in the scrum is terrifying, and all Puma forwards must be revolving in their graves. And France, they've really got to show themselves to be almost a complete team. None of this, oh, half of it was good, half of it was bad, and we'll try to be next time. We will know. I think we'll know on Saturday evening, or you'll know back at home at Saturday lunchtime, if England have got any problem in this pool or not. And wouldn't it be lovely, for the sake of the tournament, if one of the two teams, Argentina and France, came out and roared and really showed us something of true class? Because it's going to be an absolutely brilliant Saturday, but that would just about sort of top it all off.
I couldn't agree more. Very, very excited for all of those games. Gents, obviously the language is a huge barrier. How have you both been coping with, just communicating with people in Japan, you know, or getting yourselves around?
Well, we are in the communications business, but I think it's fair to say that we're failing on most fronts here. Jonesy and I managed to get a train from the right place to the right place, and we thought that was an absolute triumph.
Well, result. I think you should. That's box ticked.
There are occasions when you get in a taxi and you tell a driver where you want to go, and you spend more time explaining and going through your phone and trying to find the Japanese characters for him to know that. And you do actually going to a place. I think my vocab's getting close to double figures. I'd like to challenge Jonesy on that. I reckon he's nowhere near.
Jonesy, how are you doing with that Google Maps? You just sort of get the phone out and just point to the taxi driver, just point to
Google Maps is actually working quite well. It is difficult to communicate with the Japanese, but not half as difficult as to communicate with Steve James on this trip so far. But all I say to you, Owen, is Domi Uyamata Genki Kudasi Radakita Kalamusu Goshi Sama Hai.
That was very, very impressive. I have no idea what you just said to
my
us.
Mouth.
But in a Welsh accent, that just sounded beautiful.
I was saying, Owen, it is very nice to be on this show. Do you think Lawrence is doing a good job or not? I said, I think he's doing a decent job. I don't care what all the others say.
Ah! Oh! And that means he's doing all right, but I'm not sure.
I thought you were in a Japanese spa there and you turned the hot tap on. Of course, whenever you visit a new country, it's essential to learn a bit of the local language, and the boys have been doing just that.
Ah, konnichiwa, Stephen.
Konnichiwa, Slotty. Genki?
Very well, thank you. Genki, Stephen?
Very well, and like yourself.
OK, so for the Ruck, Jonesy and I have been working hard on our Japanese language skills, and we are going to try and do an occasional language lesson for Ruck listeners. So I'm going to kick off now with phrase number one. All black, kanarazu mata. The All Blacks think they will win again.
This is... I'll repeat this twice, as it's quite complicated. Manu tulagi ferakala orimashita. Manu tulagi ferakala orimashita. That means Manu tulagi has jumped off the ferry.
Phrase three. Ah, Johnny Sexton mata keiga shikata yo. Oh dear, Johnny Sexton is injured again.
Okay, and here's another one. Listen carefully. Lawrence Dallaglio, sumo likishi dezu. Lawrence Dallaglio, sumo likishi dezu. Lawrence Dallaglio is a sumo wrestler. He's got the feel for it.
It's come to that time where we need some serious predictions for the weekend. Jonesy, starting with you, give us our winners over the weekend.
Winners on the weekend are Australia in a high-scoring game, maybe an 8-try match. South Africa, not so high scoring, but throwing down a marker. And in my dreams, but I hope it comes true, I think France will beat Argentina. I pray they show us enough to be a competitive team, Lawrence.
Well, I'm going to wade in there with a resounding opening day victory for the hosts as well, Japan. And Owen, can you see anything different there from Jonesy?
The sort of either-or game is the Kiwis and the Springboks. I would just suspect that the All Blacks will win that. I think that France will grumble to an unimpressive victory over Argentina. They'll keep all expectations low and they will explode to life when they finally play England.
My thanks to Owen Slott, Stephen Jones, Steve James and Alex Lowe. The Ruck returns on Monday to dissect all the action from the opening weekend at the Rugby World Cup. Make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe now via Acast, iTunes, or your preferred podcast provider.